When you suggest to people that their money should be gold or silver coin, as it says in the Constitution, they sometimes stare at you with a blank expression or make the most extraordinary comments.
Do you feel that our paper currency should still be backed by gold or silver?
I think there should be a backing for currency. Otherwise, there's a temptation to run it out and make too much of it.
I'm not really sure what you mean. Like, change the color of our money or something, or?
I buy silver.
Gold.
I don't know a lot about the subject, but I would say just because of counterfeit.
I think it should, but unfortunately it isn't.
Okay, why do you think it should?
I don't think the current system is stable.
These statements by everyday American citizens show how little people understand the intentions of the Founding Fathers.
As the Constitution itself says, it is the supreme law of the land. And therefore the Constitution ranks ahead of any statutes of Congress, any statutes or constitutions for that matter of the states, and decisions of the courts. And any law or decision of the courts that is inconsistent with it is to that extent void. It's not a law at all.
So, what's going on here? Why does the Constitution clearly state that our money shall be coin, yet we are using government-issued, supposedly official, paper dollar bills? And we can't even redeem these for silver any longer. And why does Thomas Jefferson, the very man who drafted the Declaration of Independence and co-authored the U.S. Constitution, warn us about banks and corporations? Something is off here.
The Federal Reserve System, to most people, seems like it is an agency of the federal government. That's what I thought it was when I first started to research this topic. But it turns out that it's nothing of the kind. The Federal Reserve is a hybrid organization. It's a partnership between the federal government and the private banks. When you look at it deeper than that, its essence is neither as a government agency or a private company. In reality, it is a cartel. In other words, it's no different in essence than a banana cartel or a sugar cartel or an oil cartel. It's a grouping of the large private corporations in the field, banking, who have come together to create agreement between themselves to limit competition, to preserve their profits, and to make sure that no newcomers come in and take away their position. That's what cartels are always designed to do. And it's a shocking thing to realize that something as prestigious as the Federal Reserve System, at its core, is nothing more or less than a banking cartel with exactly those same objectives.
The motivation for Congress to go into partnership with the elite bankers who formed the Federal Reserve is clear. Endless amounts of money could effectively be printed up and lent to Congress. Thus, individual congressmen would no longer be forced to depend on raising taxes to generate additional revenue, an unpopular action that can cost them re-election. Ironically, if there were no Federal Reserve, there may have been no need for an income tax. The country did fine without it for 137 years. The income tax amendment was introduced the same year the Federal Reserve System was formed, 1913. Coincidence? Prior to the formation of the Federal Reserve System, the country never did better. In fact, that was the problem. At least for the major banks. Capital formation, also known as savings, was happening all over America. Other than panics, many of which were caused by unethical lending practices, America was doing great. So much so, the big New York banks were losing business. But why isn't the mainstream media telling us this story? What would motivate them to refrain from a critical interpretation of banking history and the Federal Reserve System, especially today, when they broadcast critical, even intimate reports on every other aspect of life?
I consider the Federal Reserve Act and the creation of the Federal Reserve as being unconstitutional. It gave the government then the power to create legal tender out of thin air, that is, to create paper money. And although they didn't do that overnight, between 1913 and 1971, that is exactly what happened. But the notion of a central bank does not fit into the Constitution. The Congress has the authority to coin money, and only gold and silver should be legal tender. And this is an absolute contradiction of the Constitution to have a Federal Reserve system and a central bank. Not a lot of American people understand it, and I would add that probably not too many people here in the Congress understand it either. I think they see it as a convenience, and I think a lot of other people see it as a convenience because they think they're protected by the type of system that we have. But a fiat monetary system or a paper money system is merely a system where the government has this power and authority to dictate and insist that a piece of paper is legal tender. And even members of the banking committee have come up to me and they say, "You mean our dollar isn't backed by gold anymore?" Not realizing that the Federal Reserve really accommodates big government bureaucrats and politicians.
There's another major problem with the system, in that the system is a cartel structure, which means that they've taken all the banks in the country and put them into one economic unit that's essentially regulated from the top by the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. Comes 1932-33, you had the crash. The Roosevelt administration came in. One of the first important pieces of legislation that was passed was the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933. And the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933 did for all industries in the economy the same thing that the Federal Reserve System did for the banks in 1913. It created a cartel structure. All the steel producers were in one group. Poultry people were another group, mining people were another group, and on top of this whole thing was something that looked like the Board of Governors called the National Recovery Administration. The National Industrial Recovery Act was challenged as to its constitutionality, and a case went to the Supreme Court, 1935, the Schechter Poultry case. And the Supreme Court unanimously declared it unconstitutional. They said this kind of delegation of power by Congress to private parties is, and this is an exact quote, unknown to our law, unquote. You couldn't find it anywhere by any method of interpretation, simply unknown. Well, the difference between the National Industrial Recovery Act and the Federal Reserve Act is essentially zero. The peculiarity here is that the Federal Reserve Act has never gotten that question to the Supreme Court.
Let's take a second look at the words of Thomas Jefferson. A deeper look at exactly who owns and operates the private banks known as the Federal Reserve System, and what their mission statement might be. The banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all of their prosperity. Interesting that Jefferson not only mentions the banks that will grow up, but the corporations as well. Bear in mind that each one of the Federal Reserve Banks is basically a private corporation. Neither you and I, the people, nor the federal government for that matter, own these corporations, these so-called banks. They are owned by other corporations known as member banks.
The Fed was formed not in Washington, D.C., not in the halls of Congress or some meeting room, but it was formed on a private island off the coast of Georgia called Jekyll Island. This island in those days was a club. They called the Jekyll Island Club. And its members were a relatively small group of billionaires from New York. People like J.P. Morgan and William Rockefeller and their business associates. When they went to the island, they all traveled aboard the private railroad car of Senator Nelson Aldrich. This was November of 1910, and he and six other men were told they mustn't be seen together, they couldn't dine together on that evening, and they must avoid newspaper reporters at all costs. One of them carried a shotgun. Just in case he had been confronted by a reporter, he was prepared to tell them that he was going on a duck hunting trip. When they got on board this railroad car, they were told not to address each other by last names, first names only. And two of them even went further and they adopted code names. They were concerned that the identities of all of these seven men might be known to the servants on board the car, and that the servants might talk about it. And in that fashion, the word would get out. Even when they got to the island and went to the clubhouse, they had replaced all of the normal servants with new servants who didn't know any of these people. And they created the Federal Reserve under those kinds of conditions of great secrecy. I can assure you that very few wars of history have ever been plotted under conditions of greater secrecy than that.
According to accidental releases of Fed stockholder information, as of 11:05 a.m., Tuesday, July 26, 1983, five member banks owned 53% of the stock in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the most major of the 12 Federal Reserve banks around the country. This is a controlling interest in the controlling bank. The major stockholders of this major bank, however, are confidential. No one, not even the government or the President of the United States, knows who they are, nor can they find out. We all began to lose track of this ownership on Tuesday, the 26th of July, 1983. Only a small group of elite insiders knows who these owners or controlling agents are in present time. Does this sound like a Thomas Jefferson operation? Does this so-called Federal Reserve System sound like something Ben Franklin, the man who invented the pot-bellied stove and co-authored the Constitution, would set up? Or does this system sound more like something George Orwell would write about in his nightmare book, 1984? Again, G. Edward Griffin.
In those days, there was a great deal of concern among the American people about the concentration of financial power in the hands of a few very wealthy and powerful financial interests in Wall Street. They called this the money trust. And the cry in those days was to break the grip of the money trust. And one of the primary purposes of the Federal Reserve Act, as it was promoted to the American people, was just that, to break the grip of the money trust. They were going to write a law that was going to take the power away from these people and put it in the hands of their trustworthy politicians, you see. Put it in the hands of the people through the electoral process. That was the propaganda behind the Federal Reserve System. So what's the purpose of the secrecy? It's because when you look at the list of these people who went, they were the money trust. They were the representatives of the banks, J.P. Morgan, the Rockefellers. They represented Kuhn Loeb and Company, Warburgs in Germany and the Netherlands, and the Rothschilds in England. This was the money trust, not only of the United States, but of the world. Had that fact been known, who these people were that were drafting the Federal Reserve System, the trick would have been exposed, and the public never would have adopted the Federal Reserve Act as, in fact, they did.
When you think about the significance of the Federal Reserve Act being passed under those conditions, the American people didn't know, but it was banking interests that were behind it. Powerful banking interests, because they wanted their assets protected. They wanted the Federal Reserve to be the lender of last resort. So if they had been loaning out and risking the money, and these loans go bad, instead of having the market take care of this, they wanted bailed out. And this is why it was a tremendous popular thing to do for the banks and, of course, the big business people who were borrowing the money. So it was very, very special interest directed, and it was designed for the elite. And even today, a lot of people don't quite understand that. So it's an educational job as well outside of Washington, but hopefully someday people here in Washington, especially the members of the Banking Committee, will gain some interest in this subject, because ultimately we will have to address it.
Where does Congress get most of its funding?
I would like to say from us, but I'm sure they have foreign investors that they also get their money from.
Okay.
Taxes.
People?
Government?
Um,
It gets it out of federal taxation, of course.
From taxes, but if you mean today, a great deal we're getting from China buying treasury bills.
They print it.
And can you elaborate on that?
They have no funding. They have no money. It's all puff and mirrors. They have no money. It's all an illusion. There's not much in back of it.
As we can see, the average American citizen has conflicting ideas as to where Congress gets its funding. In actuality, Congress gets most of it by borrowing it from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve gets the so-called money by effectively printing it up. The whole process is known as the Mandrake mechanism. Thus, today's paper currency, far from the gold and silver coinage stipulated by the founders, is essentially created out of thin air.
Most people are alarmed when they hear about the fact that the Fed can create money out of nothing and charge interest on it, so-called interest. It starts with Congress. Remember, a moment ago I said that the Federal Reserve System was a partnership between a cartel and the federal government.
Mr. Chairman, we've got to go vote, and we want to thank you for being here with us for today. And,
well, if there's a partnership,
thank you also for,
there's a reason for the partners, both of them, to be in it, or they wouldn't
more
be.
Than a pleasure.
So why is the banking fraternity in this partnership, and why are the politicians in it? Congress needs more money. They always need more money. They like to spend money. That gets them elected. They don't like to raise taxes because that gets them unelected. The answer, of course, is that they borrow it. If you're not going to tax it from somebody, you can borrow it from somebody else. And that's why we have government bonds and treasury notes and bills and so forth. And we have what's called the national debt, because they've borrowed money to pay for current expenses that they don't want to pay for through taxes, because that would be unpopular. So 30 days after they borrowed $1 billion, or 60 days, whatever the term of the loan is, they have to pay that money back. Well, lo and behold, it turns out that the congressmen and the senators are still not taking in as much money in taxes as they are spending in benefits, so they don't have the money to repay the loan. So what do? Easy. Borrow some more. Borrow enough to pay back the original loan, plus a little bit more to keep them in office. So this process goes on and on and on, and that's why we have the national debt growing and growing and growing. The Federal Reserve enters the picture at this stage because, you see, they can never borrow enough from the private sector. There's never enough existing money out there for the politicians to borrow. So what do? They go to the Federal Reserve System, and by agreement, remember this is their partner now, the Federal Reserve System agrees literally to create the money that they're going to lend to the government. It's not really a lending at all, as you can see, but they use the old traditional words of lending it to the government, when in fact all they're doing is just printing it for the government. They're creating it for the government, and then they call it a loan. Of course, they don't print it all because most of it's checkbook money. But nevertheless, the process is the same as if they had just turned on the printing presses and printed all this money and gave it to the federal government. So now, once the Federal Reserve System creates this money out of nothing, literally, it's fresh money into the society, into the economy, and that's how the money supply keeps growing and growing and growing. What about the banking partner? What's in it for them?
I come in and I give the bank, say, 100 ounces of gold, and the bank offers me some interest payment on that. They're going to pay me 3% interest. And they're going to take that 100 ounces of gold and they're going to lend it out at 5%. That's how they make their money, the 2% spread. Okay? Now, that's fine so far, because I know that gold is in there, it's being loaned out, and someday, now I'm getting 2% interest, and someday I can ask for that principal back. It might be 6 months, it might be a year, whatever it is. Where the trick comes into this is the bank says, not only are we going to lend that money out, but we're going to allow you, Mr. Depositor, to draw on that money right now. All right? Which means that they can't possibly be saying that I can draw 100% of that deposit when they've also loaned out 100% of that deposit. Now, maybe they don't loan out 100%, maybe they don't loan out 90% or 80%, but whatever it is. And that's the fractional reserve concept. They don't have enough reserves to pay out all of these obligations that they've made, especially with respect to paper currency, because usually that's the way it worked. Now, why do they do this? Well, they do this because they make money.
Right? If I can loan out essentially more than I have in my reserves, by that difference I'm increasing interest payments. So the bankers are beneficiaries of this. And obviously the first lender, the person that receives that money, is a beneficiary because he's getting money they wouldn't have gotten otherwise, even though he has to pay interest on it. But then what happens down the line? This is the fascinating part about it. The market has set prices and wages on the basis of what it believes is the total amount of money that's in circulation. Along come the banks and they start generating new money that the market doesn't know about. It finds out about it because the money goes into circulation. So I'm the first user of this money. I've just received the loan from the bank. I'm going to go out and buy cement with it. And when I buy cement with it, cement is at the original market price. Now, as that money starts percolating into society, the market realizes there's more money than there was before. More money chasing the same amount of goods means the prices of goods go up, right? So eventually, somewhere down the line, that same cement that I just bought for $5 a pound is going to cost someone else $6 a pound. Now, if he buys that cement at $6 a pound before his income has increased commensurately, what's happening to his real wealth? He's losing real wealth, right? His costs have gone up, his income stays the same, his real wealth is decreased. Whose real wealth has increased in this transaction? Mine and the bank's, because we got the full value of the money right at the beginning. So this system transfers wealth somehow. You can't exactly follow it, but the principle is there. It transfers wealth from society to the creators of money.
For every $1 billion that's put into the banks, I, as a commercial banker, can create an additional $9 billion and push them out into the economy as loans. Now, that $9 billion, based on the $1 billion, which itself was created out of nothing, all of it is just fiat money. It's created out of nothing, but the commercial banks get the bigger end of the deal, as you can see. They can create nine for the private sector called loans, and these are genuine loans. And that is where our money comes from. That is how money is created. Every bit of it is created in this fashion. Every bit of it is based upon debt, and that debt creates money that literally has nothing behind it at all. Now, this is how money is created in the Western world. And it's an amazing story. Only a very few people at the top know how money really comes into existence.
Best estimates say that a network of about 7,000 people, mostly located in large urban areas worldwide, facilitate the acquisition and control of the voting stock of these banks by proxy. The marching orders as to where literally hundreds of trillions of dollars of monetary power will be directed are believed to be given by the 7,000 on instructions from an insider control group we estimate to number about 300. Of the 300, many are related to one another by blood, marriage, and business ties, and, it would seem, have family ties to the original robber barons of the Industrial Revolution at the turn of the 19th century. More importantly, however, most of the 7,000 involved in this group may be largely unaware of their negative effects on society. They may sincerely, but naively, believe they are simply doing good. Nevertheless, now talking about the 300 who form the inner controlling body, we estimate that about 50 of this group are anything but naive. Thus, having successfully established the ultimate money-making machine, the Federal Reserve System, this nefarious cartel of tyrants is in a position to literally acquire control over the assets of the world, deprive the people of all their prosperity, as Thomas Jefferson would say. This is the calculus of the situation, and this is exactly what they are doing, with a little help from their virtuous but ignorant servants in Congress, as John Adams might say. Yes, the Founding Fathers must surely be rolling over in their graves.
The original intent of the Constitution is spelled out quite clearly, not only in the document, but in the immediate history that surrounds its formation. Now, Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 limits the powers of the states. It says, no state shall coin money. States had coined money. stops them from doing it. No state shall emit bills of credit. Now, that's one of those peculiar words. If you were living in that time, you knew what it meant. It meant essentially what we call paper money. No state shall emit bills of credit, which means that a state itself cannot create paper money, and then it can't do it indirectly by setting up some kind of a bank that's controlled by the state. Third provision in that clause is, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. And notice the language, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin, meaning states can and should make gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. But the historical background shows absolutely clearly that paper money was not going to be allowed at the national level or the state level. And the very interesting point here is that the same people who wrote the Constitution had been, to a large extent, in control of the states and of the Congress under the Articles of Confederation during the War of Independence. These people had emitted large amounts of paper money. The states did it. Congress did it. And that Congress did it was called the Continental Currency. And most people are familiar with the phrase, not worth a continental. Paper money depreciated so radically in value that it was essentially worthless. Those same people looked back at what they had done only a few years earlier and said, we're not going to do this anymore.
The inflation isn't rising prices. The inflation is the government's program of increasing the supply of money, which devalues the currency, and that causes the prices to go up. Inflation, that is the destruction of money, eventually wipes out the middle class. The best example in the 20th century being what we saw happen in Germany. As the runaway inflation came, the middle class got wiped out. In the early stages, of course, somebody benefited. Eventually, it hurts everybody. But in this country right now, we have constant, insidious inflation. So there is a transfer of wealth from the poor and the middle class to the wealthy. But because it affects the business cycle and causes prices to go up in general, who suffers the most? The people who can afford it the least, that people on fixed incomes, low middle income people, poor people. I think it especially hits hard low middle income people who are trying to make it on their own and won't go on the dole, because their prices go up more and they're the first ones to lose their job when the business cycle turns down. The Federal Reserve, by increasing the credit, creates the boom part of the cycle, but then there's always the resulting downturn of the cycle when unemployment rises.
We're always live.
It's almost impossible to believe that the all-powerful dominant media, what Bill O'Reilly calls the elite media, would endlessly cover all these issues, yet be silent on the very subject that is common to all of them. Money, and the entity that creates and manages the so-called money supply, the Federal Reserve System. Why is this?
One can never watch enough television.
There has been a tremendous concentration of the mass media over the last 50 years, from over 100 companies to 6 companies. Back in the 1934 Communications Act, each media company was only allowed to own a handful of stations, and they weren't allowed to have cross-ownership. They couldn't own all the media in your town. Now, they can own more and more because congressmen who've gotten elected as a result of the mass media have given them more and more. That means very few people have the right to speak to us over television, over radio, through the New York Times, the LA Times, the different news media. The whole purpose of the First Amendment is to guarantee that we have more, not less speech. However, when you start to get down and say only a few people can put up their soapbox, only a few people can address the audience, suddenly you've limited the amount of speech. Now that's the government control of speech. On the other hand, when those few people recognize that the government is the one that's licensed them to speak, they start to act in a way that's not going to jeopardize that relationship.
Could this be one of the reasons any critical reporting of universally important issues, such as the Federal Reserve, have been cut out of the public debate for so long? As Ted Turner relates in his article, My Beef with Big Media? Why would major media corporations, corporations that control the information flow to 95% of the American citizens, fail to report on the detrimental activities of the Federal Reserve System? A government-sanctioned, quasi-private banking cartel that literally controls 100% of the money flow to the same citizens, as well as the lion's share of the money flow to Congress itself.
The amount of money it costs today to run for Congress or even to run for president is obscene. And most of that money goes into television commercials and spots and all of the mass media advertising that needs to be done to reach the 295 million Americans, a vast number of people. And when that person wins, if the media has supported him, naturally he wants to pay them back. He may not think of that consciously, but in appropriating licenses and expanding territories and allowing them to own more than one media outlet, that's exactly what happens. As a result, the number of media companies, as we said before, has concentrated in a few hands. And unfortunately, Congress and the media work together to present an image to the American people that does not always include every aspect of the truth. This reciprocity, this in cahoots process, has obscured many of the more important issues to the American people. And there's no more important issue than the issue of fiat money.
When you give men the power to create money out of nothing, you shouldn't be surprised if they turn around and create money out of nothing, because that's what they're supposed to do. Now, the underlying philosophy is that, well, we'll be very conservative about it. We won't run rampant. We won't abuse this power, would we? So we give them blindly this power to create money out of nothing because we trust them to use this power wisely. Nowhere in history has this ever been a justified trust. Every time man has had that power, and this started back in antiquity, those with the power have abused it, and they have created more and more and more money at a rate much faster than the expansion of goods and services which are being produced by the productive side of the economy. Now, if the goods and services were growing at a rate which is exactly the same as the money supply, then the purchasing power of the monetary unit would remain constant. In ancient Rome, if you had a 1 ounce gold coin, that would be the cost of a nice toga, a handcrafted belt, and a pair of sandals. Today, thousands of years later, if you have a 1 ounce gold coin and you convert that into Federal Reserve notes, you can walk into a store and buy a nice suit, a handcrafted belt, and a pair of shoes. The real price of those items, and all items for that matter, throughout history, does not change when measured in terms of something of intrinsic value, such as gold or silver, because those things take human effort to produce as well as the belt, the toga, and the sandals. Both of them take human effort to produce, and that's why they maintain value with each other. But once you break that away, and you give men the power to expand the money supply without that discipline, they're going to expand the money supply faster than the increase in goods and services. And then you're going to have this difference in purchasing power. We call it inflation.
Well, it's always politically popular to impose financial burdens on somebody else. It tends to be politically difficult to impose financial burdens on someone who's living alongside of you, because they tend to have votes and they tend to have representatives who will take their position. It's fairly easy to impose a financial burden on the future, because the future generation tends not to have any votes or representation at all in the present. As soon as you start talking about monetization of debt, where the banks come in and now buy governmental debt with new money that the banks have created through this special privilege they have of creating money in the Federal Reserve System, the redistribution of wealth that takes place through that process, most people don't understand. It happens through depreciation of currency, and the depreciation of currency usually leads to increases in prices, which the average person calls inflation. Inflation is really the increase in the money supply. The prices increase is a consequence of that. But the average person doesn't understand how this happens. And he's going to blame gold speculators in Switzerland. He's going to blame greedy unions. He's going to blame price gouging. He's going to blame everybody but Congress and the banking system. So it's easy politically, through monetization of debt, to expand borrowing beyond prudent levels. Now why is that tyrannous. Well, at a certain level, it's tyrannous. The definition of tyranny is the exercise of a power that no one should be allowed to exercise. Okay? And it's tyrannous because no one should be allowed to exercise a power that puts burdens on people that are not allowed an opportunity to be heard, an opportunity to vote, an opportunity to have some kind of a say. Right? Granted, to some extent, you're going to have to do that in the nature of government as long as you have borrowing, but beyond a certain point, it becomes tyrannous. And it's beyond that point that the present system allows our political structure to move too easily. How much, take for instance, how much is the purchasing power of Federal Reserve notes lost since World War II? About 90%. You think that hasn't had some consequence in terms of redistribution of wealth, in terms of the way the economy has developed? Of course it has. The average person doesn't see it. He can't follow the lines of cause and effect, but it's there, and his life is quite a bit different from what it would have been if that hadn't occurred.
Purchasing power? Monetization of debt? Inflation? What do we mean by all these terms? Terms we may have heard many times, but still fail to connect the dots. Are you confused? If so, you're not alone.
Inflation, I think, is a bad word, because really, we think of inflation as rising prices. But in reality, what's happening, prices are not going up. It's that the value of the dollar or the monetary unit is going down. That's what's really happening if we understand the process. And it's a tax, therefore. Our lost purchasing power, what we have to pay more for a bag of groceries today than we did 5 years ago, comes out of our pocket, comes out of our earning capacity. That is value which we should have, but it's been taken from us through a process that we call inflation, but in reality it's a hidden tax. Inflation is the result of being able to create money out of nothing. And that is the power we have given to the Federal Reserve System. Therefore, we can say that the Federal Reserve System is the agency of a hidden tax called inflation.
Since the early 1900s, almost no one talks about the country's banking system anymore.
What happened? There was a shooting, then there was nothing.
Yet our money, like water, is one of the most important commodities we have. More than that, the quality of our money affects the productivity of every man, woman, and company in America. As time goes on, people figure out better ways of doing things, better ways of making products, cheaper and faster. For instance, one farmer can now grow food for thousands of people, whereas he used to be able to feed only his family. Thus, everything should be getting cheaper, because the supply of everything has been growing faster than the demand. This is true even though the population has been growing as well. Unfortunately, this is not what we observe. With the exception of a few industries, like the computer industry, and products we import from places like China, it seems that almost everything is getting more expensive, but oftentimes cheaper in quality. How can this be? Over the decades, the productive energy of society seems to be getting siphoned off.
Well, it's hard to predict, but I certainly think it's possible, because I think the financial bubble worldwide is something that we have never experienced before. We've had tastes of that. But Alan Greenspan, in one way, is a genius, and in another way, he is an unbelievable threat to us. He's a genius in the sense that in a technical fashion, he's been able to keep this system of inflation together longer than anybody else has been able to, especially in this last go-around from 2000 on. With the collapse of the Nasdaq bubble, we really didn't have much of a recession, because he immediately started inflating massively, taking interest rates down to 1%. And now, of course, he's a little bit frightened about the bubble, and he's curtailing credit to some degree. But the dollar has become the gold of the world. The world central banks have accepted the dollar as if it were gold. Greenspan claims that they have gotten the paper money to act as if it is gold, which I strongly disagree with, and all the hard money people disagree with. But I believe he's been capable of creating this huge financial bubble, and the world has not yet seen what may come of this. So I suspect that depending on when it comes and what we do, it could very well end up into a much worse situation than the Great Depression. But if the country decided, well, something has to be done, and we went to a gold standard and limited the creation of credit, curtailed the power of the Fed, I think it would iron out all our difficulties. When Argentina periodically would just quit inflating and maybe tie their currency to even the dollar, price inflation went like from hundreds of percent per year down to 2% or 3%, so it's rather rapid. So you would see an immediate benefit. You would iron out the severe swings in the business cycle. The price problems would be diminished, but the one thing we'd have to give up, which to me would be a benefit, government would have to curtail spending because they can't tax the people enough to pay for all those bills. So we would have to curtail our spending. So that would be, to me, a tremendous boost to the American people and to the economy. At the same time, we gave sound money. I mean, this would be fantastic. Within months, there would be some people who would suffer from the adjustment period, but it might be the people who have benefited so much over these years. But the average person, the poor person, the jobs would become available. So it would not take a long, long time. What would take a long time is if we refuse to consider it and the problems get worse and we have a severe recession or depression and huge inflation and we do all the wrong things. That is what we should work so hard against.
We must get rid of the fiat money system. How do you do that? Well, the first step, of course, the big step, the biggest imaginable step, is for people to realize that they even have one. I mean, how many people walking up and down the streets that go into the polls each year and elect their leaders, how many people know that we have a fiat money system? How are we going to change that unless we have an understanding, an educational foundation at the electoral level? So this is where we have to start.
Because so many people in the U.S. are now semi-illiterate, thanks to the government-sponsored public school system, it may be possible to stimulate a discussion on the Federal Reserve only through films and TV shows. In many ways, film has replaced the written word for the masses.
What is the Federal Reserve System?
It's where they generate the money and they keep the money, I think.
Federal Reserve System is a banking structure owned by the banks and run by the government.
No, I don't know much about
that. Okay, thank you.
It's a system of balancing the flow of currency throughout the United States so that as banks need to have liquidity, they have it, and as they need to tighten up money, they tighten it up.
Similar to what you had said earlier about having the reserves for when we go in a crisis or something, and you need to have that actual backing, not just a dollar currency, because paper is paper, and if you don't have that gold or silver behind it, then it's just going to be paper.
It was established in If I guessed, I'm not sure, 1913 perhaps, to establish stability in the American financial system.
I don't know the answer to that. What is the system?
It's a banking system that's run by the government. It's almost like a fourth branch, but it's run by the government, and it's guaranteeing that banks will remain stable. And if they're not stable, they'll take it over.
A way of backing up the money. I don't know. Yeah.
And what is the Federal Reserve System?
Do you want Andrew Jackson's opinion of the Federal Reserve System or what?
Your opinion.
I liked his. It's a bunch of organized crooks.
Wow. Now that citizen is informed. Too bad everyone is not as aware of how far we have strayed from our founding principles.
Well, the major problem you have not only with the Federal Reserve System, but with any statutory structure that's unconstitutional, is it doesn't square with what's called the Supremacy Clause, the Constitution, which says the Constitution and laws passed in pursuance thereof, that is, constitutional laws, are the supreme law of the land. So obviously, if you have a statute that doesn't square with the Constitution, it's void. It is not a law, in fact. So the question then arises, well, how does that square with the oath of office of representatives, senators, judges? And the answer is it doesn't. That when they come face to face with a statute that is in contradiction of the Constitution, they are to treat the Constitution as the supreme law and treat that statute as void. So that's number one. Here we have a system, the Federal Reserve System, that has all of these constitutional problems, and everyone is essentially looking in the opposite direction. So that doesn't square with the oath of office. And one would think that the president, being the head of the executive department, in which we find the Treasury, Department of Treasury, right, which interacts quite closely with the Federal Reserve, might have something direct to say about that. And then, of course, the president has a specific constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and the supreme law of the land is the Constitution. So you would expect, on top of all of this, that he would be saying, wait a minute, if the Constitution doesn't square with the Federal Reserve Act in one or more ways, then I should be giving directives to the Secretary of the Treasury to take certain kinds of action to deal with that. And, of course, we see exactly the opposite. We see the Federal Reserve people, usually the chairman of the Federal Reserve, comes to Congress, and he tells Congress directly, and usually tells the president at least indirectly, here's how monetary policy is going to be implemented. So the Federal Reserve is the tail that's wagging the dog when we have all of these questions that it may not be legitimate at all in whole or in part. If you want to see the way power goes in a system or the way the laws are corrupted, follow the money, and the Federal Reserve is a huge agency for the creation of money.
You study monetary history throughout thousands of years, you will find out that paper money has been tried many, many times, and it never succeeds. It always ends badly. The question is when will the dollar end badly? Will it be next year or in 5 years or 10 years? I'm convinced it will end unless we do the right things, and that is restore soundness to the money, put restraints on our government, either strictly curtail the power of the Fed or get rid of the Fed. That will be the only way you can save the dollar. But if we continue to do what we're doing now, we will eventually destroy the dollar.
Throughout history, as governments grow, they limit the individual's rights. The same thing happened in the Roman Empire. We know this from history, but we also know it from Shakespeare's wonderful play, Julius Caesar. As we start moving toward a bigger and bigger government, it's going to mean that the individual no longer has the right to own his property, the right to do what he wants, the right to live freely, the right to worship as he wants, the right to speak as he wants. The government starts to tell us what to do. Most of the time they think they're telling us what to do in their best interest, but the trouble is that government, as Adam Smith pointed out, John Locke pointed out, as the great thinkers of all time have always pointed out, don't really know what's right to do. Government often makes the wrong choices because it doesn't understand the consequences of its actions. So even when it doesn't desire to be a nefarious force, to be a dark force, it often is.
The problem that we have is the result of legislation. Congress has to make fundamental changes in the present system. I don't think that it's possible to impose from the top down even the constitutional system, because no one out there now is used to using gold and silver as their money. So what needs to be done is to create a competitive system of currencies. Leave the Federal Reserve System there. Slowly, over 6 months or a year, take away some of its legal privileges, its legal tender privilege, its privilege is the only medium to pay government taxes, so forth and so on. And over on this side, create a gold and silver system. And then you will have competition between the two, the paper money price structure and the gold and silver price structure. And it will be a competition. What happened is in this competition, gold and silver would win out, because in competition, the free market usually wins out over governmental intervention and special privileges. And that's the reason we have governmental intervention and special privileges, to keep the free market from winning out. And that's why they go to government to ask for legal privileges, all right? So that's the first problem. Now, the second problem is I don't see that happening through Congress, because there are just too many loggerheads in Congress to get the thing started. So my suggestion is that it begin in some state, a small state, a state that probably has a certain amount of its taxes that it can hypothecate to gold. And if the system worked and more people were asking, then the state could expand the areas of taxation and bring more people into it. And eventually you would, if it worked, you would see the whole state, the state's monetary system, the government, state government, would be on a gold system. And then I would think as well you'd begin to see that spreading into the economy. Now, if that were to happen, then I think other states would look at this and say, well, that makes sense. Let's begin to move in that direction. You could look at it essentially as a monetary insurance policy. They don't have to go beyond 10%, but 10% gold holding is perfectly prudent. And if something were to happen in the economy, if there were to be a monetary crisis, a banking crisis, then the state could rapidly expand the system because people would know how it operates. But the idea is to get the mechanism, as it were, on the table so that people can see how it works, why it works, what its benefits are. They don't have to be afraid of it. And arguments along the lines of there's not enough gold and silver in the world to do this will, you know, that kind of thing will be shown to be fallacious.
Concerned citizens should be asking themselves questions like, why do you feel like you're on a treadmill that's constantly running faster?
Hey.
Why does it now take a two-income family to make ends meet, thus preempting women from their traditional role of providing stay-at-home child care? Why do we see a never-ending expansion of government, even though our elected officials endlessly promise to reduce it? Where does the government get the funds to wage perpetual war, yet fails to provide the basic protection citizens needed on September 11th? Why do rich people seem to be getting richer, while you and all your friends seem to be hardly making ends meet? Why does a first-class stamp now cost you nearly 40 cents when it used to cost only 5 cents? Should a 90% loss of purchasing power be tolerated? Where does it end?
It's easy to see where we're headed. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. If you follow a graph, and you can see that there are points on this graph and they're going constantly in one direction, and they've been doing this for 50 years, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see where it's headed. Where this graph is headed is for total destruction of our monetary system. Our money will be totally worthless, and it'll probably be reissued in the form of some international currency, which will be equally worthless. But the value to these people is that once it's on an international basis, there's nowhere else to go. Right now, if you don't like American dollars, you can buy Japanese yen. If you don't like that, you can buy Swiss francs. If you don't like that, you can move to whatever currency seems to be having a little better track record. Once there's an international monetary system in place, modeled completely and exactly after the Federal Reserve System, it's exactly the same, then there's no place else to go, folks. You've had it. So that's where it's headed, and if we don't turn this thing around, I think we're going to be living in kind of a modern serfdom. And we'll be serving masters, and they won't be living in the big castles that we can see, at least, and say, well, that's where the master lives up there, and we're tilling his field. Our masters will be the bankers and the politicians, and they'll live in big houses, but they won't be castles. But we'll be serving masters nevertheless, and we'll be thinking they're wonderful people without realizing that they are our masters. If the United States went back to constitutional money, it would be an amazingly wonderful event, because it wouldn't be just going back to constitutional money. In order for that to happen, that means you'd have to assume a groundswell of awakening on the part of the electorate. And they would understand not only what's happening in the monetary system, but what's happening across the board in our political system. I think we would have a great resurgence of prosperity and tranquility. That means that the electorate would have to be questioning a lot of other things in our society as well. And I think we would see an improvement across the board, and I look forward to that day.
Americans need to stay on top of one of their most influential institutions, the Federal Reserve System. They need to start asking questions, not only of their representatives, but of no less than the President of the United States, whose sworn duty is to uphold the law of the land, especially the supreme law of the land, the U.S. Constitution.